Airplane Intel Podcast, episode 46. This week, we're back to single-engine land airplanes to compare the Cessna 172 with the Piper PA-28 Cherokee and Beechcraft Musketeer, plus aircraft ownership news, alphabet soup, and Don's tip of the week.
Welcome to the Airplane Intel Podcast, the show for aircraft owners, pilots, and mechanics. It's our goal to save you money and make your flying safer so you can get the most out of your airplane. Featuring the pre-buy guys with over 60 years combined experience flying, maintaining, and managing all types of aircraft. We will share practical advice, strategies, and tips to help make aircraft ownership simple, safe, and cost-effective. So stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Airplane Intel Podcast. We're an aviation podcast that focuses on the ins and outs of aircraft ownership. And it's our goal to help you make smarter and safer decisions when it comes to buying, maintaining, and even selling your personal or business aircraft. I'm Adam. I'm a pilot, AMP, and graduate of Embry-Riddle. And I am joined by my co-host, Don, who's got more acronyms after his name than I can even count. Hey, Don, how's it going? And tell us a little more about what we're going to be talking about today.
Welcome back to the Airplane Intel Podcast. Thanks for visiting us again. Well, we're going to be back to airplane single-engine land and maybe an airplane that you want to buy. So if you're an aviator that needs a four-passenger airplane, this is the podcast for you, because we're going to look at a couple different single-engine, four-passenger airplanes, the Cessna 172 versus the Piper Cherokee series, and also the Beechcraft Musketeer. Yes, we're going to kind of explain the difference of these airplanes. We're going to talk about some maintenance issues in each one and probably what you're going to pay for these airplanes. Then we want you to visit airplaneintel.com, because our show notes have some excellent videos comparing these airplanes, and that'll get you aviators up to speed before you go ahead and buy an airplane. So stay tuned. We're glad you're back.
Yeah, that's right, Don. Welcome back, everyone. We do appreciate you being here with us as usual. A couple things before we get started. Number one, I did post that YouTube video that I mentioned in the last episode about the Mooney M20D. So head on over to YouTube when you get a chance to check out that video. I also put a link to it in the show notes for this episode at airplaneintelpodcast.com, episode number 46. So you can see it there under the bonus video section. Number two, next week we're going to be back to our series about how to buy an airplane, and we're going to feature an interview with the president of AOPA Finance, Adam Meredith. And he's going to share a lot of really interesting insights and tips for what you should know about financing an airplane. So you'll want to check that out. And finally, if you're an aircraft owner, we would love to interview you on the show. It's a really great way to tell your story and talk to us about your airplane and your experience with owning that airplane. And it could be any airplane. So send an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com if that's something that would interest you. So anyway, that's about it for updates. Let's go straight to the news. And our first bit of news comes to us from Flying Magazine, and it says NTSB uncovers clues related to the Piper in-flight breakup. As the investigation into last month's wing separation on a Piper Aero near Daytona Beach continues, the National Transportation Safety Board on Tuesday issued an update that points to a number of wing fractures. The PA-28R-201, aka Piper Aero, was owned and operated by Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University as a Part 91 instructional aircraft at the time of the accident. An FAA designated pilot examiner and an ERAU student taking his commercial pilot check ride perished after the left wing separated from the airplane shortly after takeoff. The airplane subsequently collided with terrain and was destroyed. Initial examination of the aero's left wing main spar at the NTSB Materials Laboratory revealed more than 80% of the lower spar cap and portions of the forward and aft spar web doublers exhibited fracture features consistent with metal fatigue. The fatigue fractures originated at or near the outboard forward wing spar attachment bolt hole. The article continues, while none of the surfaces exhibited visible evidence of corrosion or other pre-existing damage, the remainder of the lower spar cap, spar web doublers, and upper spar cap displayed fracture features consistent with overstress. The right wing also exhibited fatigue cracks in the lower wing spar cap at the same hole location extending up to 47 thousandths of an inch deep. At the time of the accident, the Piper Arrow accumulated about 7,690 flight hours on the airframe and 33,276 cycles. The NTSB inspected another Piper Arrow on April 18th and 19th that had completed nearly the same number of flight hours and cycles and was used exclusively for student flight training. That inspection included removal of the Arrow's wing and also revealed a crack indication at the lower left outboard forward wing spar attachment bolt hole measuring about 40 thousandths of an inch. The second aircraft's wing was subsequently reinstalled and examined using new inspection procedures developed by Piper Aircraft, including a bolt hole eddy current inspection. Investigators are also researching a 1987 wing separation that occurred aboard a fixed gear Piper Archer to determine if any corrective actions discovered 30 years ago might have been relevant to the Daytona Beach crash. Now, this is obviously a hot topic if you're looking at a Piper Arrow or any of the Piper PA 28 and 32 line airplanes, because a lot of the parts are shared between these airplanes. So we've posted some service bulletin information that you might want to check out, as well as a couple videos that goes into more detail about what to look for and what some of the potential consequences are to having corrosion or fatigue cracking in the spar area or in the wing attach fittings. So we posted some videos in the show notes, as I mentioned, and you can also download the service bulletins, specifically service bulletin 1006 and service bulletin 1244B. So check those out when you get a chance, because it's kind of important. So if you're thinking about purchasing a PA 28 series airplane, this is definitely something you should be taking very seriously. Our next article also comes to us from Flying Magazine in a little bit lighter news. It says here, tracking devices can provide peace of mind for both pilots and family members, and like most electronic devices, these portable units have become smaller as technology has progressed. Garmin recently introduced the InReach Mini, a pocket-sized satellite communicator that is small enough to fit in a pocket and weighs only about 3.5 ounces. The InReach Mini connects to the Iridium satellite network, providing position tracking, SOS services, and the ability to communicate via two-way text messaging, even when far outside regular cell phone service. The unit also provides access to maps, aerial imagery, and NOAA charts, as well as some weather services. The device provides communication capabilities through a wide range of compatible products, including Garmin's Pilot app and a variety of Garmin smartwatches, including the aviation-specific D2 Charlie. The InReach Mini has an internal rechargeable lithium battery, which lasts about 2 days with default 10-minute tracking mode and up to 20 days with extended 30-minute tracking mode. The InReach Mini will be available in the next few weeks and is priced at about $349. A satellite subscription plan is also required for the unit to work, with pricing starting at about $15 per month. If you'd like to learn more about this, the InReach Mini, you can head over to the show notes where I posted the full article. Our next article comes from bizjournals.com, and the headline is "The Most Popular General Aviation Aircraft in Quarter One." And it's showing a slideshow of SR-20s and SR-22s, the Gulfstream G550, a Diamond DA-42, a Piper Archer, and a Cessna 182, of course. And the article continues by saying, driven by an improved turboprop market, the number of combined global general aviation aircraft deliveries improved modestly in the first quarter. According to General Aviation Manufacturers Association, GAMA, total first quarter deliveries increased 2.8% this year to a total of 447, which includes a 12.7% increase in deliveries for turboprop airplanes for a total of 115, and business jet deliveries increased as well, 1.5%. for a total of 132, while piston airplanes declined to only 200 deliveries. The overall value of these combined deliveries increased 3.3% year over year to an estimated $3.83 billion. These are industry-wide results that closely mirror the first quarter results from Textron Aviation in Wichita, which led the way in overall deliveries at 88 on the back of improved turboprop and a slight increase in business jets. Also contributing to the overall results were three deliveries of the locally built Learjet business jet by Bombardier Business Aircraft. So there's actually a lot more figures here and a nice slideshow in this article. So if you want to see it, head over to the show notes. Our final article today comes to us from AOPA, and it says VOR shutdown update. Whether you fly from point to point using the latest navigation equipment, or hop from one VOR to another under VFR in a legacy aircraft, no pilot will be unaffected by the modernization of the air traffic control system as familiar old nav aids disappear from charts and direct routings become the new norm for navigation. As of April, the FAA has discontinued 23 of the more than 300 ground-based nav aids it plans to shut down by 2025 as more aircraft equipped to fly performance-based navigation routing enabled by GPS. Selecting nav aids for removal involves evaluating whether a nav aid should be kept in service as part of the minimum operational network, which will serve as a backup system designed to ensure that an aircraft can navigate to an airport within 100 nautical miles of a nav aid and shoot a VOR or ILS approach in the event of a GPS service interruption. The article continues and says AOPA has recently been involved in several discussions with the FAA on the future of HIWAS. When deciding whether to retain a HIWAS outlet, the FAA examines whether there is an overlapping HIWAS coverage at 5,000 feet AGL, adding that nav aid shutdown should not degrade the HIWAS system. AOPA has recommended that the FAA update the Aeronautical Information Manual with language to explain the nav aid decommissioning process and educate pilots about how they can submit comments on the proposed decommissioning of nav aids if they believe a nav aid should be maintained. So if you'd like to learn more or contribute to this discussion, head on over to the show notes where you can find the rest of this article. The Cessna 172 and Piper Cherokee are pretty comparable airplanes. Obviously, there are some differences in ramp presence between them, but overall, their performance specs are almost neck and neck. Both airplanes share similar operating costs too, which I'll get into a little later. In terms of the market, Cessna seems to be priced a little higher than most comparable Cherokees. Controller.com lists a total of 74 Cessna 172s for sale, ranging from about $28,000 to about $120,000 for earlier models and all the way up to $300,000 plus for later models such as the 172SP. Likewise, Cherokees are ranging from about $20,000 all the way up to $80,000 and about $250,000 for late model Archers. In general, you'll find 172s priced about $5,000 to $10,000 higher compared to similar year-range and total time Cherokees. The price difference is likely due to popularity and commonality with the 172. Simply stated, more pilots learn to fly in the 172 than in the Cherokee, and that has created a higher demand for them overall. In terms of engines, the 172s have options for a 145, 160, and 180 horsepower engine, both from Continental and Lycoming, depending on the year. Cherokees have options for a 140, 160, and 180 horsepower engine, all from Lycoming. Now, of course, some Cherokees have larger engines found on the Dakota, Pathfinder, and Arrow models, but those airplanes are outside the scope of this particular discussion. Now, useful load on both airplanes are similar, roughly 800 pounds depending on the model, and cruise speeds are also similar, coming in to a realistic 110 knots, though the 172 might be a touch faster in some circumstances. Systems on the two airplanes are also pretty similar, with a few exceptions. For example, the Cherokee has mechanical flaps controlled by hand with a Johnson bar, whereas the 172 has electric flaps, at least found on the 172F models and beyond. The flap drive motors and actuator transmissions have been known to fail, and parts can be somewhat expensive to replace. A used motor can be about $900. That said, parts and maintenance support for both airplanes are virtually the same as both manufacturers continue to produce variants of their respective aircraft. ADs for these airplanes are also comparable, at least for now. As I mentioned in the news section, the wing separation that occurred on the ERAU Aero may warrant an AD at some point for Cherokee model airplanes. Many of the wing components are shared between the Aero and the lesser performance Cherokee models, so keep an eye out for that. And of course, if we hear anything about an AD coming out for any model airplane, but particularly for this Cherokee model, we will be sure to let you know. I would also caution that several service bulletins exist for wing and spar inspections on the Cherokees, two of which I posted in the show notes, as I mentioned. And in the same vein, though, Cessna has what they call supplemental inspection documents, or SIDs, on the 172 for similar inspections on the wings and wing struts, as well as elevator torque tubes. So be sure to do your homework there. Now, you may be able to have some or all of these service bulletins or supplemental inspection documents worked into the sales contract, where either the seller agrees to pay for the inspections, or you agree to pay for part of them, or you work out some sort of deal where the inspections get done as part of the sale. But ultimately, apples to apples, both the 172 and Cherokee are mechanically simple airplanes, and maintenance doesn't get much easier or inexpensive. All in all, I recommend flying both airplanes to see which you like more. Unlike many other aircraft, your selection between these two airplanes is going to come down really to personal preference between high wing and low wing, and which aircraft you feel more comfortable with. I'll say, though, that legroom in the rear seats is probably better in the 172 than the Cherokee. So if cabin space is important, that's definitely something to keep in mind. However, one thing to take note of is some of the design and performance changes that occurred over the years between the 172 and the Cherokees. As I mentioned, each model has three engine choices, as well as some updates to their systems and layout, and some cosmetic differences as well. Thus, there are slight variations in gross weight and useful load, so be sure to do your homework to determine which variant of the 172 or Cherokee will best meet your needs. If you're instrument rated, take both airplanes up in IMC conditions to see which is more stable. Some say the 172 is more stable, while others claim the Cherokee is. It really comes down to your personal opinion, though. Now, let's shift gears for a moment and talk about the Beechcraft Musketeer. Now, we've covered the Musketeer already in episode 16, but it's worth mentioning again because it's not nearly as popular as the other two airplanes, yet an equal contender. However, like anything in aviation, there are trade-offs. The Musketeer has a larger cabin and a more spacious cockpit, and easier access to rear seats than its low-wing competitor, the Piper Cherokee. It also has a higher useful load, close to 1,000 pounds, actually a little more, and a higher gross weight. However, the trade-off here is speed. The Musketeer only cruises at about 105 knots, while sipping about the same amount of fuel as the slightly faster 172s and Cherokees. Musketeers have a 165 horsepower Continental engine, but some models also have 150 horsepower Lycoming engines. There are also several variants of the Musketeer with different designations, such as the Sport, Sierra, and Super Musketeer, with higher powered engines and retractable gear. So be sure you're looking at models that meet your needs. Perhaps the biggest advantage of the Musketeer is sales price. Now, these airplanes range from about $20,000 all the way through $35,000, though their inventory is much smaller than the Cherokees and 172s, with only three aircraft for sale on controller. Though, in my opinion, the overall build and design quality of the Musketeer is at least somewhat better than the Cessna and Piper equivalents, and I think the Musketeer is a slightly better looking airplane. Now, Beech still supports parts on these airplanes despite the fact that production ceased in the early 1980s. If you'd like to learn more about the Beechcraft Musketeer, which, like I said, is a pretty good airplane and a very good contender and one that is overlooked, I recommend checking out episode 16 where we interviewed the owner of a Beechcraft Musketeer. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Now, let's take a look at three airplanes for sale. First, a 1963 Cessna 172D with a $32,000 asking price. Now, the 172D, by the way, has mechanical flaps controlled by a Johnson bar, and it was the first 172 model to introduce the lower rear fuselage with a wraparound OmniView rear window and a one-piece windshield. Gross weight was also increased from previous models all the way to 2,300 pounds. I also noted that new rudder and brake pedals were added to the 172D, and over 1,100 were built. Now, this particular 172 only has 2,280 hours on it, which, you know, honestly could be a red flag because it means it hasn't flown much, but it really depends on where it's been based and has been maintained, which you'd get a better idea for by pulling the FAA records and going through the logbooks. Now, this airplane is based in Washington State and only has 860 hours since overhaul. The airplane is in current annual until November 2018 and has a STOL kit, a short takeoff and landing kit, as well as the Powermatic. Now, the Powermatic is a Continental GO300E engine, and that produces 175 horsepower and cruises about 7 to 10 knots faster than the standard 172D. Now, the listing claims that the airplane has all of its logs since new, which of course is good, and says to call for more information. Now, there's not a whole lot more on the listing, but the paint, I can tell you, looks pretty decent, though it doesn't say when it was last redone. Interior also looks like it's in decent shape, and the panel has been updated since the airplane was new, but it's still very out of date by today's standards. And it doesn't look like it's GPS equipped either or ADS-B ready. But anyway, I put a link to this airplane's listing into the show notes. Next, we have a 1979 Cherokee Warrior II located in Texas. Now, there's only three photos in this listing, so it's difficult to judge the overall paint and interior condition. They're asking $29,900 for this airplane with 6,309 hours total time and a fairly high time engine, about 1,863 hours since a major overhaul. Now, this means you'll likely be spending some money early on with this airplane, as overhaul costs are about $22,000. But a borescope and a flight test would definitely give you an idea as to the overall health and condition of the engine, as well as maybe if the owner has been doing any kind of oil analysis or that sort of thing. We can also cut open the oil filter and check for metals to see, you know, what the engine condition really is, because obviously you can fly these engines far beyond TBO, depending on how they were flown and maintained and what the overall condition of the engine is now. And like I said, it's located in Texas, which is a good thing, because most of Texas anyway is not a corrosive environment. Now the panel looks pretty original as well, so plan on spending an additional $10,000 to $20,000 on avionics. But the airplane does have the Knots2U wingtip STC, and you know, that's a pretty nice STC to have. Makes the airplane look a little sleeker, and there's some performance gains with that STC as well. But overall, it's a pretty good looking airplane with wheel pants, and the paint looks to be at least a 6 out of 10 from what I can tell here in these couple of pictures. Now the Warrior 2 has the Lycoming 0320 engine producing 160 horsepower, a 2,350 pound gross weight, and the more attractive tapered wing. Now I posted this listing in the show notes for you as well. Finally, we have a Musketeer for sale on Controller. They're asking $29,800 for this. It's a 1967 A23 model located in Ohio. And the airplane has about 2,932 hours total time with only 200 hours on the engine. Now this particular airplane has the Continental IO346 engine, which produces 165 horsepower. Now I'll tell you, I think these Continental engines, while solid, are a little bit more maintenance intensive than the traditional Lycoming engines that are found on some of these other airplanes that we're talking about. Now this listing doesn't have any more details on the airplane other than what I mentioned, but here are some decent pictures. So unlike the other two airplanes, the panel on this Musketeer, though pretty much original, has a standard six-pack layout, which the other two airplanes did not. It had kind of the shotgun panel. So that's definitely a welcome change, especially if you're an instrument pilot. You know, you're used to that scan, and that six-pack will be really helpful for you, and you might be able to get by without doing a whole lot to the panel in the, you know, immediate future. I'd also say that the paint looks fairly new, and it's actually a nice red color. Anyways, I put a link to that airplane in the show notes as well, and I think you guys get the overall picture here. So let's go to Don, who's got some more information for us about these three airplanes.
Hey, thank you, Adam. You gave us the lowdown on those three different Mica models for sale, because there's a lot more out there, but we can't do them all. Anyway, I believe these three airplanes don't have any damage history, according to a little site we used to look that up. So let's see, what else could help you folks out deciding what kind of airplane to buy? How about episode number 42 and 45 of the Airplane Intel podcast? Adam gives you the lowdown. Yeah, you'll be well prepped to buy an airplane when you listen to what Adam has to say. And I have a little input too. And then we have now that Musketeer by Beechcraft. That's kind of an uncommon airplane. Not many people really know that. I kind of favor that airplane in a way, because it's usually you're getting more for your money. Even though it's a little slower, it has a much larger cockpit. Matter of fact, back in episode number 16 of Airplane Intel podcast, we interviewed Mike. Now, Mike is an airline dispatcher, so he knows his way around the skies. And he's in partner with the Musketeer. And if you go back to that episode number 16, and maybe fast forward it to about 21 minutes, if you don't want to listen to the whole thing, you could hear Mike telling you about his adventures in his partial ownership of this Musketeer. It's quite interesting. And Mike also has a podcast. So I'll tell you what, we put a link to that podcast in our show notes. So you can click on that. And if you don't want to listen to us, you know, back then, because that was history of the airplanes we had for sale back then, they're probably all gone by now. So just fast forward about 20, 21 minutes and listen to what that Mike has to say. Now, what's the difference in these airplanes? Well, let me give you a couple of the big numbers. I guess you probably know already that the Cessna 172 is one of the most popular airplanes ever built, if not the most popular. Over 40,000 Cessna 172s were built. The Cherokee isn't too far behind. About 32,000 Cherokees have been built over the years, all the different models. Of course, they're still making the 172, but it's not cheap. What, $600,000 or $700,000 maybe? Well, it depends what kind of options you get on it. Now, what about this Beechcraft Musketeer? That's kind of an airplane a lot of people don't know about. And there wasn't that many built. I think there was about 6,000 built. So what's the difference in how many has been built? Well, let's say you need a major component like a wing. I hope you never do need one. But chances are you're all going to find a wing for a Cessna 172 in the salvage yard. Hopefully it'll have the original logbook so you can make sure that wing has never been repaired. Now in the Cherokee series, it gets a little harder. As you know, well, you may not know, but there's an AD coming out on the wing, and Service Bulletin 1006 has the spark corrosion inspection. You got to take out the fuel tanks, and they found a couple of corroded spars. So I don't know how many plane wings are out there for Cherokees that have, because if you need a spar, you need a whole wing. It's hard to replace just a spar. So I don't know how many's out there. Is that a little bit of a problem? Now the Musketeer, being that there hasn't been that many built, chances are major components like that are a little harder to come by, I would imagine. But you know, most airplanes have common parts. The engines, no problem. The propeller, no problem. The interior, usually it's no problem. It's just if you need a major component that you'll have to try to get one someplace. Well, let's start off with the Musketeer. You know, I'm talking about that. It has a little bit wider cabin. So if you're a kind of person who doesn't like to climb up on the wing to get into the airplane, then you don't want a Musketeer. That's a low-wing airplane. So is the Cherokee. But the Musketeer has a wider cabin, so if you're kind of wide yourself, it might be a good fit. And once you get up on the wing and climb in, it's pretty easy to get to. It's usually, I find out, you get a little bit more for your money on a Cherokee. On a Musketeer. And there's a lot of different models. The Model 19 is the original Musketeer Sport. And because that's like it had a smaller engine in it. Then the Model 23 had 180 horsepower in it. And it had a bit more speed and about 100 pounds more useful load than the 150 horsepower Musketeer Sport. And the Model 19 came along, and that was a real popular trainer. And they even, we have a video in the show notes showing the different, one of the other models, they souped it up a little bit with 200 horsepower engine in it. Yeah, four cylinder also, so you might want to check that out. Now the Cherokees, of course, you know, they have a marginal four place Cherokee called the Cherokee 140, and they put a little larger engine in it. And but still, it's, you know, it's a pretty good two passenger airplane, even though it has a back seat, unless you have a real short trip to fly. So the most popular Cherokees is the 161, the 180 horsepower. They even make them up to 235 horsepower, but they're usually up over $50,000 or $60,000, that model. So these low wing airplanes, the Cherokee and the Musketeer, they have a little bit of ground effect when you're landing, and because the wing is so low to the ground, you get a little more lift when you're close to the ground, so they float a little bit down the runway. And the Cherokee PA-28s have three oleostrut shock absorbers, and not only the nose wheel, but on the two left and right main landing gear. So that requires a little bit more maintenance, simply because those seals go bad occasionally. Of course, it's a good idea to wipe them down with a little hydraulic fluid that you use to service the brake reservoir with. And if you keep the grit off them, the O-rings in those oleo struts last a long time. So it's a low wing, so that means you got to get on your hands and knees to drain the sump tanks. Where the high wing, yeah, that's easy. It's right there, right above the doors. And, you know, this Cherokee also only has one entrance door, and the Musketeer also. And you got to climb up on the wing to get to it, where the 172 has the two doors and those nice opening windows on the side. And so it depends what you want to do with the airplane. If you want to do photography, there's no doubt about it. You need probably a high-wing airplane because you're not looking down into the wing. You're looking down into the ground. But if you have people that, you know, have trouble climbing, and it's a little easier with the two doors getting into the Cessna 172 model. And of course, the 172 model is so popular because it has good handling characteristics. I believe the Cherokee is a little quieter in flight. And I guess there's a few reasons why. I believe it's the way the engine is built in front of the airplane, a little soundproof in the air in the firewall. And also the windows don't open. They do make an optional scoop you could put on. The side windows have a port that opens up. You can put an air scoop on that. But most people, you know, on those Cherokees and Musketeers, they crack the door open a little bit in the hot weather when they're taxiing, because none of them really have air conditioning. Because they do make a portable type of cooling. It's like an ice chest with a fan in it. And you fill it up with ice, and it keeps the plane a cooler. The problem is, of course, until you get airborne. So it depends. We in the past on our videos too, we had talked about these airplanes. So you might want to go back and look at the prior videos. And it's a matter of opinion. Do you like the looks, the curb appeal? Do you like a low wing or high wing? And you know, the other factors are with a low wing, when you're turning the traffic pattern, it's easier to see the airport. But then on base to final, that right wing is up in the air if you're in a left-hand traffic pattern. So you need to dip it down to see if there's anybody else on final. Where a high wing, you could look down the final approach course if you're in a left traffic pattern, or even a right one, and you can make sure that nobody is coming in you didn't know about it. So that's kind of the big differences that I see. And we like your feedback. Tell us your experiences. And hey, yeah, if you ever want to get together, hey, I'm here in the middle of North Carolina. 1BQ, maybe you heard of that airport. It's in Carthage, North Carolina. It's south of Raleigh, and it's just a little west of the Fort Bragg Military Reservation. And they have an excellent barbecue restaurant that's open on the weekends. And so if you want to fly in there, they're open during the week too. So if you want to fly in, we'll grab a bite to eat and sit right on the runway and have our lunch and talk about your airplane. Just give me a buzz.
Yeah, Don, thanks for your insights there. I do appreciate it. And also, guys, if you're in the Orlando area, we can meet up as well. I'm down here right next to Orlando Executive, KORL, and I'm also pretty close to Orlando International. So if you happen to be in town for whatever reason, or you're flying your airplane around here, I would love to meet you. So feel free to give us a call or send an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com if that's something you'd be interested in doing. Now let's talk about the cost of flying these types of airplanes, okay? Now, you're going to find that the cost is more or less the same. We're burning about 9 gallons per hour. We're going to make some assumptions here in terms of fixed costs and some of the variable costs. So in terms of fixed costs, we're assuming the airplane is not being financed, though if it is, you can expect the terms about 120 months and an interest rate of 4.5%. That's about the average right now, so you can do the math on that and add that into your total, you know, either annual cost or your hourly cost, however you want to break that down. We're also making some assumptions here that you're going to spend probably about $1,000 a year in crew training, or, you know, pilot training. You know, that's your IPC, your BFR, probably updating manuals, doing any kind of subscriptions for flight, that sort of thing. We're also assuming that you're going to be spending probably about $6,000 or $500 per month, $6,000 a year on hangar costs, about $700 a year in insurance, and maybe about $3,000 for miscellaneous items, unscheduled maintenance and consumables like tires and brakes and fluids and things like that. So anyway, when you add that up, now you can take into account, we're making an assumption in terms of variable costs that we're flying about 50 hours per year, that fuel costs about 4.25, which is the average right now. We're burning 9 gallons an hour, so that's $1,912 and 50 cents basically. And we can also then add in some money for our engine reserves, which is probably about 10 to 13 bucks an hour, really depends on the status of your engine, which engine you have in that particular airplane. But essentially, you can expect, you know, with those numbers to be spending about $100 per hour plus or minus $5 or $10. And that's your all-in cost. Now, obviously, you know, if you don't have a hangar, that cost might be a little less. Maybe your insurance is less. Maybe you get lucky year to year and don't end up paying very much money in maintenance costs and that sort of thing. Or you perhaps don't budget in your engine reserves. But anyway, that's approximately what you can expect to spend, about $100 an hour, plus or minus. And in most cases, that will beat your rental costs, especially if you're flying a lot of hours to build time, or if you're looking to do a lot of cross-country trips, that sort of thing, or just get your feet wet in aircraft ownership. It's really not a bad deal. And we've talked in previous episodes of different ways you can save some money on your annual fixed costs, particularly your maintenance costs, and you know, if you have the option for cheaper fuel and that sort of thing. So there's some planning involved with that, of course, but that's more or less what you can expect to spend. In today's alphabet soup segment, which we haven't done in a little while, I wanted to cover an acronym that you're going to see a lot while searching through these listings, and that is SMOH. And I don't think we covered this in the past. If we did, I do apologize. But anyway, SMOH stands for Since Major Overhaul, and it typically refers to the engine. And as the name suggests, it's talking about the time and hours since the engine was overhauled. Now, the question that will arise from this is, what type of overhaul was it? And basically, that might lead into some other acronyms, but essentially, we have four choices when it comes to overhauling an engine. The first one is a factory remanufactured engine. And basically, that's really not an overhaul because it results in a zero-time engine. You can, in other words, throw away the old engine logbooks, and you have an engine that's basically a quote-unquote zero-time new engine. And so essentially, you send in a run-out engine, the core of the engine, to the factory, being Continental or Lycoming, and you get back an engine that's built to new engine standards. Now, some parts might be reused, such as some of the lower end of the engine, the crankshaft and the case itself, but all the top end parts are replaced generally with new. And because it's done at the factory, they can certify it as a zero time engine. Now, the next choice you have is a factory overhauled engine, and that is essentially where you send the engine to the factory for overhaul, but it's not zero timed. You're going to be paying a little extra money to send your engine back to the factory for overhaul, so that would be cleaning and replacing of parts that are required to be replaced. Some of those parts will be new, some of them will not be, and it's really not much different than an overhaul shop doing the overhaul. But, you know, that might have a little bit of a selling point if you're looking to sell the airplane, if you say that it has a factory overhaul engine. And you would see that acronym as SFOH, which would be since factory overhaul. And by the way, a factory remanufacture would be SFRM. Now, the other choice would be, as I just alluded to, would be an overhaul shop that does the overhaul of the engine. Same basic process applies here. You send the engine in, parts are inspected and cleaned and replaced as necessary. Now, the next option would be a field overhaul, where a properly licensed A&P can go in and overhaul parts of the engine. And the nice thing about that is that it's usually performed locally by a mechanic, maybe an independent mechanic or a small shop. Now, the thing here is to make sure that you have the proper paperwork associated with all of the parts that have been replaced or restored. That would be your yellow tags or your 8130s, and those should stay with the aircraft's records. Now, of course, there's another one, and that would be top overhaul, and so you would probably see that as STOH, but not necessarily. It may still say since overhaul, or TSO, time since overhaul. It may even say, which isn't necessarily accurate, since major overhaul. And a top overhaul really is when the cylinders are replaced. Now, there are pros and cons to each of these different choices. However, the big thing here that I'm trying to get you to take away is that you have to be clear as to what type of overhaul was done on an engine that you're looking at and a listing. And moreover, you need to know who did it and make sure that all the required paperwork is there to support the overhaul. So anyways, if you guys have any additional feedback or commentary on this, we would be happy to hear from you.
It's time for the tip of the week.
Well, here's my tip of the episode. So you're going to go out and look at an airplane, right? Maybe it's right at the local airport or just a short drive away. You know, if it's a long ways away, You're probably not going to go out unless you make prior arrangements, maybe with us to do either a virtual pre-buy ahead of time and go over the FA file and, their logbooks with you. But anyway, you're not doing that. You're heading out because it's fairly close. So what do you have to bring with you? Yeah, bring with you. Yeah. Well, we recommend that you bring, if you're going to go flying in the airplane, we recommend you bring a can of disc brake cleaner. They sell it at the auto parts store. It has a little straw type of nozzle you can put on it. And the reason to bring that is because if you're going to fly in the airplane, you want the owner or operator to take off the top cowl, and you want to make sure there's no oil leaks. And if there is oil leaks, you've got your can of disc brake cleaner. You could just spray in those spots where you see the oil, and it just evaporates right away. Magic disappears. Especially, look under the in the accessory case. Any place you see a little oil congregating, maybe in the bottom of the cowl, don't flood it. Just give a quick spray a few times and dissipate the oil. Because when you come back from that flight, you're going to want that owner-operator to take off that top cowl again. Because what if you have a crack in the case? That'd be pretty serious. Or some bad oil leaks. So that's one tip. And hey, why not bring your smartphone, of course, or maybe your tablet, but why not bring a spare battery? You could buy them in Walmart for as little as $10 with a connection cable to charge your phone. Because you might get there and say, I like this airplane. I think I need some help. Yeah, well, if you need some help, just give us a call on the spur of the moment. You never know. We might be in a position to do some live streaming with you. In other words, we have a program called Zoom, and we send you a link, and you click the link on, and it says you want to attend this guest, and you say yes. And there we see everything you're seeing. You put an earplug in your ear, and we could start a pre-purchase inspection right on the spot. Yeah, we could read the logbooks with you, or just take pictures of the logbooks to read later. If you don't have a digital copy and we can't do it in advance. So go prepared. And there's a bunch of other techniques that we do, and I don't know if you want to do it. Make sure that you can get up to the, if it's a high wing airplane and you don't have maybe a good leg where you could step on that strut step or the step on the side of the fuselage and pull yourself up. So you might want to bring a little ladder with you, one of them little folding ladders. Maybe 2 feet will do it. If you have a 3 foot one, that's better yet. You can get a better look at the wing and the fuel. And yeah, bring a sump trainer with you because it might not have one in the airplane. And you want to check all the sumps and see if there's trash and water in them. And you don't want that one in the airplane smell like fuel when you go flying. You have to put it back in the airplane. Yeah, a couple common tools. I kind of like the fuel strainer. It has a combination screwdriver. It has a Phillips on one side and a common on the other, and they fit almost all the cowl screws to take the top cowl off. And because you don't want to do that personally, so the tip is, if you go out to check out an airplane, you don't want to be pilot in command. And even if the owner says, get in the left seat, well, you're almost considered pilot in command in the left seat because it's a verbal thing. But if you have an accident of some kind or maybe damage the plane taxiing, if you're pilot in command and you don't have insurance probably for this airplane, you're responsible. So you want to make an agreement if you go up for a flight test that the owner sit in the left seat. And if he wants to let you use the controls, that's fine, but make sure that it's an agreement that you're not pilot in command. So there's my tip on checking out a used airplane.
Well, thanks for those tips, Don. We do appreciate it. And something that probably you don't really think about when you're in the moment and you're excited about looking at an airplane. But bringing those things are going to make your life a little easier, and you're also going to be able to evaluate the airplane a little bit more effectively. I would also mention that you should probably bring a flashlight as well, And I suppose that's pretty obvious, but like I say, in the heat of the moment, you might not think about it. Anyway, guys, we're going to wrap it up right here, and next week we're going to be talking with Adam Meredith from AOPA Finance to give us the lowdown on what you need to do and what you should know when financing an airplane. So you're going to definitely want to check that out. Be sure to leave us your feedback by sending an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com. And don't forget to check out the show notes at airplaneintelpodcast.com. So anyway, with that, we look forward to seeing you again next week. Thanks for joining us today. And keep the greasy side down. And until next time, stay safe, everyone. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Intel Podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope that you'll subscribe to the show and follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter by searching Pre-Buy Guys. To access show notes, archives, and other free resources, head on over to airplaneintelpodcast.com. To get answers to your questions, drop us a line on social media or send an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com. You can also reach us by phone at 904-290-3870. And remember, owning an airplane doesn't have to be hazardous to your wealth.